Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the CEU Press podcast series. I'm your host, Andrea Talaber. My guest for this episode is Gábor Klanicai, Professor of Medieval Studies at the CEU's Department of Medieval Studies. Gábor has published extensively on the historical anthropology of Christendom, on comparative religious history of Hungary and Central Europe, and on the uses of the Middle Ages in modern history. Gábor is also the series editor of the Central European Medieval Texts, CEU Press's series of critical editions in Latin and English translation, along with Patrick Geary, Gerhard Jarit, and Pavlina Richterova. His forthcoming edition, co-edited with Ildikó Csepregi, is The Sanctity of the Leaders, containing the lives of saints canonized in the 11th to 13th centuries in the newly Christianized countries of Central and Eastern Europe. Welcome to the podcast, Gábor. And before we turn to these critical editions, could you tell our listeners a little bit about your academic background?
Thank you very much for having me. As you have heard already, I'm dealing with the history of medieval Christianity, and I've been doing that for several decades. At first, I was teaching at the Eötvös Loránd University of Budapest, and when CU was founded in the 1990s, I managed to convince the university that a new university needs a foundation in the classical subjects, classical disciplines, which founded universities also in medieval times. So there was a creation of the Department of Medieval Studies, which is a different thing from history in the sense that it is an interdisciplinary or multidisciplinary research and training students in being able to use the methodologies of several disciplines, that is, besides history and historical source criticism, also art history, archaeology, paleography, historical anthropology, literature. All these things are very important also because CU does not have all the disciplines. So, in a way, the Department of Medieval Studies was providing a combination of these disciplines and also putting CEU on the map of international cooperation in these fields. Now, the department has it's celebrating now the 30th anniversary. We have, in the 30 years of our existence, provided MA dissertations for about 650 students and about 150 PhD dissertations. The fascinating experience in this department was to have here first, above all, a selection of students from former socialist countries, East European countries, and that was also allowing us to have a combination of the hidden expertise of these countries, because Middle Ages was, although studied in the previous decades, but the results of the scholarship in these various countries were preserved also because of linguistic difficulties. Nobody could read for decades what was written in Polish or in Czech or in Hungarian or in Romanian or in Bulgarian. Now, with our English language education and also with our international contacts, we could serve as a kind of mediation. I must mention that the department was founded in cooperation with Janusz Bock, who served several decades as professor in Vancouver at the University of British Columbia. There was the archaeologist Jozef Laslowski. There was also the Austrian expert of culture of daily life, Gerhard Jaritz. And we had also an art historian, Béla Zsolt-Szakács, or historian of religion, Marian Ság, or a historian of patristics, István Perczel. And I cannot enumerate now all the participants because the department grew bigger. But the experience was that this combination of disciplines was attractive also for the students coming from all around, from America, from France, from Germany, from Italy, but also from the global world. So now, in the third decade already, we had a very strong presence, for example, in the history of the Near East with Ottoman studies or the Eastern Mediterranean studies and so on. But I will not enumerate now everything. I wanted to get to this presentation, rather, of the book series.
Next to the university's commitment to medieval studies, obviously the press also has a big commitment to it. And the series that we are talking about is the Central European Medieval Text Series. And I mean, the CEU Press has been publishing in that series since the late 1990s. Could you describe what the series is about, what is its purpose, and what prompted its creation?
There are such series in international publication world. The model for us was the Oxford Medieval Texts. These bilingual editions are useful because the knowledge of Latin is declining, unfortunately. We try to counteract, and our students do learn Latin, and we do have a thorough education because the students of medieval times must have their source languages, Latin or Greek for Byzantine studies, or Syriac for Near Eastern Christianity and others. But to have a publication republish these sources with an appropriate English translation, that's now all around purpose of scholarly editors and publishers. And we propose CU Press to have a series which would correspond to these Western publications, because the sources, the most important narrative sources, we wanted to concentrate on these narrative sources in Latin language in Central European countries, were published in editions which were critical, well done, but they were inaccessible for the larger world. They were either like the Monumenta Polonia Historica published around the turn of the 19th and 20th century, or the Hungarian series of the Scriptores Rerum Hungaricarum was also from the 1940s. And even though some of them had been reprinted, these were not very well accessible, and they were, of course, only in Latin. Also, we thought that we have a good background, academic background, to do this, because it's not only bilingual edition, but it is provided with explanatory contextual historical footnotes with an introduction from one of the leading experts of the field. And for this, we had to mobilize our international network. In the first place, what I must say is that you mentioned the present editorial board of the series. At the beginning, It was the initiative of Janusz Bock, my colleague. He had a practice in this type of source edition already earlier. And the board consisted of Giles Constable, who was the director of the School of History at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. There was Ursula Borkowska, an excellent professor of medieval religious history from the Catholic University of Lublin. There was Ferdinand Zeibt, a great expert of Czech history on the one hand, and also somebody representing German scholarship from Munich, and myself. So that was the first editorial board. And the purpose was to publish the principal narrative sources, above all chronicles and hagiographic sources, legends, and some other narrative accounts from the medieval period, medieval meaning here because this region was converted to Christianity around the first millennium, so from the 10th to the 14th century.
So I wanted to pick up on this issue of Latin knowledge, or the lack of Latin knowledge these days, because obviously the series is not only important for scholars of medieval history, but also for scholars of modern and contemporary history, as the Middle Ages are often used in modern historiography to bolster claims of historical legitimacy of the nation, with many Central and Eastern European states dating their origins to this period. So I was wondering whether, who is the intended audience for these texts? Are they accessible also for the non-specialist or for the modern contemporary historian?
Of course, it's also for the modern historians. If we go into see the topics of the volume, of course, well, these medieval sources are being read also by all history students, and not only history students, but also art historians or archaeologists or others. They are important for research, but they are also important for the larger public. And if we get to the individual pieces, I can give some examples how it is also important in modern public history or public debates on history. But what I want to say is that the intended audience is threefold. One is that the essential precondition of university studies and also research is that research libraries throughout the world, and that several hundred such research libraries or university libraries, must have these source editions. These are the building stones of the work of historical and art historical and literary historical research. And they have to be provided in a appropriate and also scholarly valid manner, so not just, because there are a lot of translations which lack these scholarly standards. So what we wanted is really to have these parallel texts. And then, of course, this is very, very good also for those who know some Latin, but not sufficient, so they can, by seeing the parallel texts, refresh their knowledge or even develop their knowledge by using these bilingual editions.
Yeah, it's quite good for practicing languages, I think. Could you just say a few words about what has been published so far, and how were these texts chosen?
We concentrate on Central Europe. That's in the title of the series. So Central Europe is roughly the area in the Middle Ages between the Adriatic and the Baltic. So it is the three big Central European kingdoms, Hungary, Czech Kingdom, and Poland. But also Croatia belongs there, because Croatia was in personal union with Hungary since Koloman the Learned from the 12th century, but they produced their autonomous literary work. So we limited our attention only to Latin Christianity, because it was with Latin sources that we have been working. We could have enlarged it to more to Eastern Europe, but first we wanted to get ready with this. Now, how it is chosen? Each country has three or four such important work. Unfortunately, medieval production of chronicles was not so abundant. And we theoretically we want to do it all, and then we need to find the appropriate translator, commentator, and also funding, because this is not something which can be just done as a hobby. And we do have some candidates for that, and we did also mobilize several times project money, and that's how it was done. Now, you asked about individual volumes, and I think it would be worthwhile to see some of the examples. So far, 9 volumes have been published, and the 10th is about to be published in April. So the first volume, published in 1999, was the chronicle of Simon of Kéza, a Hungarian chronicle writer from the 13th century, around the 1270s, titled Gesta Hungarorum, The Deeds of the Hungarians. And this chronicle was very famous in the Middle Ages, because it was the first to describe a story of the origins of the Hungarians. Medieval nations had all an origin stories, and this origin story of the Hungarians, written down by Simon of Kéza in the 13th century, so one must retain that Hungarians came to the Carpathian Basin in the late 9th century, and so 4 centuries later. This ancient history, according to Simon of Kéza, was that the Hungarians were descending from the Huns, and the Hungarians came to the Carpathian Basin to take back what was already theirs in the time of Attila the Hun, who had famous world empire and almost defeated the Roman Empire. And this was very much a central building stone of the Hungarian national consciousness. And after Simon of Kéza, a lot of other histories in more detail, kind of with a literary fantasy, describe these origin stories, the myth. And this became, in the modern history of the national consciousness of Hungary, very big debate, because in the 18th century, linguists pointed out that the Hungarian language is not of Turkic origin, but of Finno-Ugrian origin. And this caused a very big uproar among the Hungarians, who wanted to have that type of consciousness of being terrible horse-riding, arrow-shooting nomads, or originating from Attila and having been mighty conquerors of the world. And they thought that this linguist theory was just the Habsburgs' conspiracy to destroy Hungarian national pride. And this debate, believe it or not, is lasting since the 18th century to our days, and considerable proportion of Hungarians want to, still to prove that the Han-Hungarian kinship is the right explanation of the origin of the Hungarians, and they heftily debate. And this is, now I won't go in detail of this history, but the volume itself contains a study by the historian Jenő Szücs, who in the 1970s analyzed that this Han-Hungarian mythology was like the French, for example. The Franks were saying that they are descending from some soldiers emigrating from Troy. So there was a Trojan origin of the French. And also this was taken over by the English as well. There are many such myths from the Middle Ages, which modern people do not consider now the right historical explanation. This is not the case with the Han-Hungarian kinship. Anyhow, to publish the texts there, that was very important. And already the publication of this volume contains the model that there is an appropriate detailed historical study tied to the volume. Now, other volumes include, for example, the second volume was the autobiography of the Holy Roman Emperor and Czech King Charles IV. Which is another genre. It's not a chronicle, it's an autobiography, but a very interesting one in that sense, that one of the first autobiography by a ruler, in a ruler who describes his youth, his dreams, his visions — he even had visions — his project as a ruler, and also his veneration of the national symbols, national patrons. He also wrote a legend on Saint Wenceslas, the founder of medieval Bohemia. And this one was preceded by a preface by Ferdinand Zeibt, who was the greatest expert of 14th century Prague. The third volume, the Deeds of the Princes of the Poles, which was preceded by a preface by Thomas Bisson, and the translation and the comment was by Paul Knoll, an American scholar, excellent expert of Polish history. I must say that in the translations, that is actually a very important, academically important work also, and we have a series editor, Frank Scher, Australian Latinist, who controlled all the texts, and some of the translations were directly made by him. And the fourth volume just to make the real geographical balance, was Historia Salonitana, the history of the bishops of Split. And that was already commented by a former PhD of ours. And this is something which I want to point out, that the series relies on two networks. One is the network of the colleagues who participated in building up the international network of our department, or our PhDs, because our PhDs grew up with this, with working with these texts. And Damir Karbic, who is an important medievalist in Croatia, was, for example, investing work into this Historia Salonitana. The fifth volume in the series was is again Hungary, which is a chronicle called The Chronicle of the Anonymous. Now, this is again, Hungarian historians know that the biggest riddle of Hungarian history, because we only know about this master called P. Dictus Magister, master said P. So we have the initial of his name, that he was a notary of a certain King Béla. Now, there were four Bélas in Hungarian Middle Ages, and which Béla, that was a long, long debate. Now, more or less, there is a consensus that it must have been Béla III, who is 12th century and in the age of the Crusades. And indeed, this Chronicle of Anonymous is describing the land-taking Hungarians. And it is somebody who is educated already with the courtly romances, the history of Troy. And it is actually the most important work on Hungarian Middle Ages and medieval history. And this is coupled in the volume by another piece, because the Chronicle of Anonymous is not very long. So there was space in the volume, and there, that is a master Roger in the 13th century who described the terrible destruction of Hungary by the Mongolian attack. In 1241, the Mongols devastated Hungary, and there was a cleric who was giving a moving and a really detailed account of what he saw and what he... It's called Carmen Miserabile, the weeping song or something like that. And this is also a reading for anybody to know a little bit about medieval reality. Now, the sixth volume is on a medieval cult of saints. And it is the saints of the Christianization age. Actually, there is a three-volume series on medieval hagiography where I myself was responsible. This volume 6 was the first published, the most important saints of the period. So Saint Adalbert, who was the Bishop of Prague, but then chased from Prague and went to Rome and then finished his life by trying to convert in Poland the pagan Prussians who killed him. He was a martyr. And then later on he became the most important saint of Central European countries. The Czechs and also the Hungarians venerate him as one of the most important patrons. And he had a great influence in founding Christianity in these countries. Then we have in this volume also one of the legends of Saint Wenceslas, the Bohemian Duke, also a martyr, also killed, but was a model of a Christian ruler. We have a description of some hermits who went to convert, like the five martyr brethren killed in Poland, or Zorad, Andrew and Benedict in Hungary, or Croatian hermit called Gaudentius of Ozor. And the introduction to this volume was written by Ian Wood, the English historian who is maybe one of the greatest experts of the missionary lives and the missionary period of European history, and is translated by two of our alumni, Christian Gaspar and Marina Miladinov. The seventh volume is the one which is now currently being prepared, and currently it's already in print, and it will come out in April. and is publishing the saints of 11th and 12th and 13th century, so the most important saints, Saint Stephen, Saint Ladislaus, Saint Stanislaus of Poland, the martyr bishop, Saint Procopius of Sazava, and this is real big teamwork. I won't enumerate now everybody in participating in it, but I must name Petr Sommer, who is longtime leader of the Czech Institute for Medieval History and who is a great historian of all the monastic history of 11th and 12th century. There is a ninth volume, which is, I think, worthwhile to mention. This publication was directed by Janusz Bak, deceased a few years ago, but this was one of his last work and maybe the most cherished work. 14th century chronicle composition was the most important medieval Hungarian chronicle. And this was also called the Illuminated Chronicle. And this is a volume which contains also a CD with all the pictures. This the 14th century was the century when the chronicles were already illustrated by beautiful and very artfully executed miniatures. There was also a legendary, an Angevin legendary, by the way, that is also published by CU Press, by Béla Zsolt-Szakács, one of our colleagues. We have another series called CU Medievalia, and that's also part of that. But the Illuminated Chronicle was also, like French and Italian miniature painters was bringing these pictures. But that was not the only thing which was interesting, but this was a kind of chronicle composition of a chronicle which was started already in the 11th century and was enlarged and rewritten several times. And again, this is a great riddle for historians to know which part belongs where. And it is also edited by an excellent Hungarian scholar, László Veszprémi, who is maybe the best expert now of medieval Hungarian chronicles, and Martin Rady, who participated in several of these editions and translations, who is also an English expert of Hungarian medieval history. Volume 10 is, again, a Czech volume, which is the Chronicle of Kozmas of Prague. That's the most important Czech medieval chronicle, also from the 12th century. And this is edited by Janusz Bak and Pavlina Richterová. It was translated by a former PhD of ours, Petra Mutlova, and also a team of Czech historians were working on making this volume, a very thick volume, as a basic source for medieval Czech history.
Thank you for these descriptions. And I mean, the way you describe it, this is very much a teamwork effort. I was interested in the nitty-gritty of, you know, how these texts are put together as critical source editions. You know, you mentioned the various translators. That in itself is quite a big challenge. So could you say a bit about, you know, how you find these sources, just in general, what is the challenge in publishing these?
Well, as I already referred to it, the translators are mostly now coming from those circles which we have trained ourselves. So, for example, in the volume which is currently being published, there are six or seven former PhDs participating. So, for example, there is a Croatian bishop, John of Trogir, who was a 12th century Reformed bishop and one of the important medieval saints. And Marina Miladinov-Schumann translated, and Anna Marinkovic, another PhD of our department, wrote a very expert commentary. Or the legend of Saint Stanislaus, the martyr bishop of Krakow, was translated by Christian Gaspar, and Stanislava Kuzmova, who wrote a PhD dissertation on Saint Stanislaus and the sermons related to Saint Stanislaus, was writing a preface. And I won't go around all of these. Essential thing is that each individual source requires a person who has done research on that, who is able to put together a commentary and also able to control the various historical notions which are mentioned in the sources. So sometimes the translator has to be clear what are the titles, what are the appropriate description of the ecclesiastical or secular offices which are mentioned in the text. And of course, it has to be in a acceptable, or even better, in a good readable English. And this is why we always have beside the translator, who is above all a person who knows Latin and who can work with us, and who is not working, I have to add, for the price a translator works in the Western world, but is accepting to work with us because also they belong to our circles. And then, of course, we must have a native reader. So, of course, CU Press also has a very good quality control. But before that, already we work with native. So, as you could hear, Martin Rady was there, for example, to control several of the texts. Frank Scher is controlling many texts. And this means very frequently also debates with the translator, because a translation of 11th, 12th century text is a tricky one. There are other translations with which our translations were not satisfied with, and they had to go into debates. I can, for example, mention the example of the legends of Saint Adalbert. A lot of debates are there in connection. Who was the author? That cannot be known precisely. There are conflicting and debating opinion on that. And we had to decide to provide, on the one hand, an appropriate representation of the different opinions and give our opinion. And then also, for example, a translator in this situation has to look at the work of other translators. So translators frequently look at whether there is a German or a French or another language translation, and have to make their own decision how to translate the problematic points. Because these problematic points sometimes are used as for historical justification of certain claims. One of the legends of Saint Stephen, for example, has a passage which says that the Hungarian ruler has full power over the church because the Pope granted them a privilege. But this was already very much debated in the Middle Ages by the papacy. But to give a precise translation of that, that's a responsibility.
Yeah, and you already mentioned that the new book is coming out soon, like in a month. So we are recording this in March 2023, and this podcast will come out in April, just in time for the launch. So, conscious of the time, could you say a few words about this new edition and what's included in it?
Well, very briefly, because I already spoke about that. So, If we say sanctity of the leaders, so there were three type of leaders which were also venerated as saints, or not all the leaders, but some of them. One is the sanctity of the rulers, and that is a very important thing, because the rulers are normally not saints, but the rulers want to have, on the other hand, a kind of sacred charisma. So the rulers want to be venerated as gods, but Christianity was refusing that for the Roman emperor. This is why they had to suffer martyrdom. Yet in the Middle Ages, kings were more and more appropriating this title, and not only in Central Europe, but elsewhere. But in Central Europe, in Hungary, it is very much so. So it is Saint Stephen, it is the founder of Christian kingdom, and also a kind of apostle to convert the Hungarians. But there is also his son, Emeric, whose legend is in the volume, youthful prince who was educated like Christian, couldn't succeed his father because he died before. But there was Saint Ladislas, who was atleta patriae, who was a kind of chivalrous knight saint, and who was fighting the Cumans, and who was a valiant and very brave fighter. This was also a sacrality which was important. So if somebody could win the battle, had that type of prestige. So Ladislas was like that. And then another type of leader is, of course, the bishop and the saintly bishop. And we have these saintly bishops already in the first volume of the series. There was Adalbert as a saintly bishop. And here we have also Saint Gellert or Gerard, who was a bishop of Saint Stephen and who was one of the organizers of the Hungarian church and who was killed at the pagan uprising after the death of Stephen, but was a model of a saintly bishop. We have Saint Stanislaus, who was a bishop who dared to confront the rulers. And that's also important because there were two types of powers in the Middle Ages, the ecclesiastical and the secular power, and they frequently had conflict. There was a famous bishop in England, Thomas Becket, who was killed by the partisans of King Henry II. And this Becket model was also in Eastern Europe. And Stanislaus was also killed by Boleslaus, a Polish king, because he criticized him. The bishop criticized the ruler. Then we have the holy abbot. That's the third type. And this Saint Procopius is representing it. And I did not mention that there is one more volume, which I forgot to speak about, although that's my very closest special research area. And the saint rulers in the 13th century were succeeded by saintly princesses. And there was one saintly princess in Hungary. There were two very famous saintly princesses, Saint Elizabeth of Hungary, the daughter of King Andrew II. But she was a European saint, not only, she was not living in Hungary, but in Thuringia, and she was becoming saint in Germany. But Saint, the niece of Saint Elizabeth, daughter of King Béla IV, Saint Margaret of Hungary, was living in Hungary, in Buda, on an island in a Dominican convent. And her sanctity is important because in the 13th century, there was a big investigation about sainthood that it became a bureaucratic, canonic affair because the popes reserved the right for declaring somebody a saint. And before that, they wanted to have an appropriate judicial examination with papal legates. And there is a canonization process documentation, the acts of the canonization of Margaret, which investigation is actually describing the testimonies of 110 witnesses who were speaking about the life of Margaret, about the miracles they attributed to her. And this is such a detailed reading of the everyday life of medieval people. There are several hundred speak, and what they tell is described by notaries more or less precisely. And we hear about family tragedies, we hear about captivities, we hear about illnesses, we hear about the life of the nuns. There are 38 nuns who give their testimonies. We hear the life of the city. So this is a fascinating reading, and this is also a thick volume of in the series. And what I could see is already that in international medievalist circles, already several scholars were very happy and already exploiting this data for giving an image of medieval cloister life or medieval miracles.
I mean, that's great to see that, you know, they are using the text that you've been working on.
So, yes, yes.
Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. We are very much looking forward to the new volume and all the relevant links regarding the series and the new publication are in the show notes to this episode. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't want to miss any of our new episodes. Gábor, thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
And goodbye.
Bye-bye.